The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
My name is Andrea, for those of you who I've not met before. And I often start these evenings with practice questions, but tonight I thought I'd just start with a talk, so hopefully there'll be time for questions at the end of the talk. So what I'd like to talk about today is insight. And the title of the center, the name of the center is Insight Meditation Center. So what is insight? What is this insight that we are exploring with our meditation practice? The word insight is a translation of a Pali word, vipassana, and that word has two parts to it, the V part and the passana part, and those two parts have different ways of being understood, but the main understanding of the passana part is that it's related to seeing or knowing, understanding, realizing, recognizing. And the first two letters, the VI part, my teacher from Burma, Saira Upandita, says it means something like various things. So in his translation, vipassana means seeing, recognizing various things. And then he goes on to describe what these various things are that we see. Another way of looking at this first two letters, I looked on the website, the Pali English website for the translation of this word to see if there is another understanding of this first two letters. And it is sometimes used as just an emphasis. So really seeing, really knowing, really understanding, something like that. And I kind of like that understanding, truly knowing. So what, to me, this points to is seeing the nature of experience. Seeing, there's a word sometimes, or a set of words sometimes translated as seeing things as they are, seeing things as they actually are. Our minds typically don't see things as they actually are, much as we would like to think that they do, much as we'd like to think that our minds are kind of like a camera audio recorder and, you know, just kind of recording the experiences that are happening. We think of our minds as being that way. I mean, I look out at this room and I think I'm seeing it very accurately. I think I'm seeing everything that's here. And yet I know from how my understanding of the mind and what I've explored that I'm probably filtering certain things in and filtering other things out. So the way our minds work, the way our perception works, the way we take in information is often filtered by agendas, by ideas, by proclivities, preferences. Certain of us tend to gravitate towards pleasant things. Others of us may tend to gravitate towards unpleasant things. This was one of my first understandings of just how non-neutral or non-simple my sense apparatus is. One of my teachers asked me, so I'd like you to just notice in your flow of experience what the tone is of the feelings that you're noticing in the flow of experience. So this was in a guided meditation in an interview, and I started noticing, and I was just calling them out. And every time I noticed something new, it was unpleasant. And this was the tone that he was talking about. He wanted me to recognize whether it was pleasant, it was unpleasant, or whether it was neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And I recognized that every time my mind picked up on something, it was unpleasant. And after about 5 minutes of this, I said, well, obviously this isn't a choiceless apparatus. You know, there's got to be an equal number of kind of pleasant things out there, there's unpleasant things out there, but my mind is orienting towards the unpleasant. So we all have this kind of filter. You may not have the unpleasant filter like I have, but we all see things from our own perspective. So our minds typically are obscuring things. We're not really seeing things as they actually are. And there's a core set of things, a core set of what we might call distortions that pretty much everyone operates with. They're kind of what we might call human distortions or human misperceptions of experience. And this is that we tend to take what is impermanent to be permanent. We tend to take what is unreliable as a place where happiness can be found, as being a reliable place for happiness. We tend to take what is not self, not I, not me, not mine, as being I, me, and mine. So these are what we might call core delusions. The insights, to bring back towards insight, the insights essentially are beginning to recognize, see through these distortions, to begin to recognize that things are impermanent, things are unreliable, and things are, there is not a solid abiding entity. We could say that there's a corelessness, an ephemerality to everything that happens. Nothing really solid here. So these core delusions around these three things, we all live with these. We misinterpret the world, taking it to be permanent, if we don't actually take things to be really solidly permanent. I mean, you ask anybody out there on the street, do things change? And they say, yes, of course, we know things change. And yet we don't really operate that way. So we may not really believe, we may not think that things are absolutely permanent, but there's some way in which we believe they should be. And when we come upon the truth that things are impermanent, that things are unreliable, we feel like we've made a mistake or we failed somehow. You know, when there's loss or when there's when somebody's opinion about us changes, or when we when there's death or sickness, we may feel like, well, you know, why is this happening to me? As opposed to recognizing this is the way it is. These core delusions around taking what is impermanent to be permanent, taking what is unreliable to be reliable, taking what is not self to be self, are kind of ways that our mind deceives itself. And when we find the rub of those experiences, when we feel the struggle around things getting lost or broken or recognizing that somebody's opinion about us has changed, that we're no longer seen to be the person that we want to be seen as, when we feel the rub of that, we feel the suffering of that, that is actually pointing us to truth. And so these explorations around impermanence, unreliability and not self, are often felt as places where we're struggling, places where we're caught, places where we're feeling dissatisfied, stressed. And so those times are times for us to look and recognize, oh, actually, this is pointing to a truth. Rather than saying, why me? Why is it happening to me that I'm losing things? Why is it happening to me that I'm getting sick? Why is it happening to me that people's opinions are changing about me? It's like this. Of course I'm losing things. This is the nature of things. It's not a failure. It's pointing us to the truth. And so if we can kind of reorient our minds around this, we can use this rub as a teacher, as a guide for us, as to where we're kind of caught in these distortions, in these misperceptions. So the Buddha was particularly interested in these distortions, these key distortions of our mind, because our relationship to the fact that things are impermanent, unreliable, and not self is the key way, the key reason why we suffer, why we feel stress, why we feel unease, dissatisfied. And his whole interest was in understanding this. Why do we suffer? His whole teaching, he said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. That's what I teach. Other things he may have known or understood, but, you know, he's like, well, those things aren't so relevant. Let's look at how the mind relates to things. Let's look at how the mind relates to things that are impermanent. Oh, we don't like that. Look at how we relate to things when they're pleasant. We want to hold on to them. We want to keep them. And that being an exercise in futility, because it will end. Trying to hold on to something that's continually changing. One student called it rope burn. You know, it's like there's just this continual flow, and we're just desperately trying to hold on, and it's slipping through our fingers, and we get the rope burn, the pain of the rope burn, trying to hold on to something that can't be held on to. So the Buddha was very interested in our relationship to these experiences and to explore how suffering is created around these. So our usual way of perceiving, recognizing in the world is kind of co-opted by these distortions. I mean, we do know that things are impermanent. But the actual truth of that, of what that means, we don't really understand that. There's one quote. I actually read it the last time I was here, but I'd like to share it again because it so speaks to this. This is from the Mahabharata. This, I think, is most wonderful, that the man of the world, even though he is seeing before his eyes constantly creatures dying and passing away, never for a moment the idea enters him, I too have to fall. I am a creature also destined to be destroyed. Even if it is told to him, it never enters his mind. Only the surface mind understands the language, but the actual sense never goes into his head. That is very much the way we are around these core delusions. The surface mind understands, yes, things are impermanent, but the actual sense of what that means, what that implies, doesn't go very deep. We behave as though our happiness can come from accumulating things, whether those are possessions or opinions of people. And we want to accumulate nice, pleasant things around us. Have good food and a nice house and good friends, and we want to accumulate good opinions. People have good opinions of us. We want to be liked and seen as worthwhile and as valuable. The things of the world are destined to change. And so if we tie our happiness to having things, we will end up in a kind of a, what is it, we might say, a kind of a squirrel cage, or, you know, a hamster wheel of, well, this thing, we get this thing, we've accumulated this thing, but the satisfaction of having that particular thing goes away either because we get tired of the thing or it gets lost or broken. And so because our happiness depends on having things, it's like, well, let me get the next thing so I can be happy again. So we end up on this kind of never-ending wheel of accumulating, trying to get things, trying to kind of string together a series of experiences that will be, oh, here's a little moment of good, and here's another little moment of good. And we think that a successful life is to string together only moments that we like, or only have opinions, people have opinions about us that we approve of. And it is just not possible. It's just not possible. There's going to be some unpleasantness in there. There's going to be some pain in there. There's going to be some sorrow. There's going to be some loss. There's going to be people who don't have the opinion of you that you'd like them to. People's opinions change. That's the one I really think is kind of amazing, that we tie our happiness to the opinions of others. How reliable are the other opinions of other people? I mean, we see our own minds change. You know, tying our happiness to what other people think of us, trying to behave in some way to get other people to think certain ways about us. Again, it's kind of an endless cycle of trying to do the impossible. So our usual way of living in the world, we are living from this perspective of thinking that our happiness is going to come from having things, holding on to them. And it's just runs counter to the way things actually are. That our happiness can't be reliably found in that way. That's the truth. That's the truth. That a reliable kind of happiness can't be found in the way that we've been habitually living. So the Buddha, in recognizing these distortions, that we tend to see the world from this perspective of things, having things, holding on to things, wanting to accumulate things for our happiness, he said that there's a way to begin to kind of reorient our minds. He suggested that we cultivate the perception of impermanence. That we cultivate the perception of the unreliability of things. And that we cultivate the perception of not self. So what does that mean? It's not really described that clearly in the texts. There's a few places where it talks a little bit about it. And it uses the language of reflection. You know, this is impermanent. So to me, what it's saying or what it's pointing to is using reflection as a way to help us begin to kind of counter our usual tendencies of how we see the world. We usually, seeing the world from this perspective of thinking that things, opinions, are going to be the place for our happiness. If we instead begin to recognize that what we Where we think our happiness will be found is impermanent and unreliable. It may counter that tendency. So, using reflection, actually consciously recognizing that things are impermanent. Bring this into our minds. Now, impermanence is staring us in the face all day long. And yet we don't really take that in. You know, in daily life, in very obvious ways, all you have to do is you know, look at the news and see how somebody, you know, the thing that just came into my mind is just remembering that accident at San Francisco Airport some weeks ago, where the plane landed and the tail came off. And fortunately, most of the people got out of the plane, but, you know, several people died. Three young girls. There may have been more. I've been away, so I haven't been in touch with the news. But three young girls died that day. And they were, you know, I just got home a couple days ago from a trip. And as I was landing, you know, it's kind of like just remembering that and recognizing, okay, you know, This is a time when unexpected things can happen. You know, most of the people on that plane were probably not expecting a plane crash in the moments before they touched down. They were probably thinking about, oh, we're here in San Francisco, all the great things we're going to be doing. And in a moment, their lives change. All it takes is just looking at the news to see just how much change there is. And then there's the simple things of life. You know, you eat a piece of fruit and the fruit is gone. It's impermanent. It's changed form. Here it is. It's now part of the body, and tomorrow it's going to be a part of the waist. You know, there's just, it's staring us in the face and we don't really see it. At one point on retreat, I was in the kitchen. I was on a 3-month retreat and I was in the kitchen chopping vegetables. That was my job every day. I chopped vegetables. And I was kind of trying to orient myself towards recognizing impermanence. And, you know, it felt kind of artificial at first. It's like, okay, yeah, I see. Here's these vegetables, and now they're a pile of cut-up pieces, you know. So seeing how there was change, but it's like the vegetable was still there, you know. And then it gets cooked, and then it gets eaten. But at some point, there was one kind of moment that was kind of startling to me. And this is where we can begin to see actual insight. It's when the mind is kind of startled by something. I walked into the kitchen, and we were doing chard that day, cutting up chard. And usually the person preparing the vegetables for us had it in buckets, and we would just, you know, pick up a bucket and dump the bucket out, and we'd work with that bucket, and then we'd get another bucket and put it out there, and we'd work with that bucket. But this day, for some reason, the person had put all of the chard on the table at once. And so it was this huge pile. I mean, I think it was like 2 feet high on the table, you know, 3 feet, 4 feet around. It was like a volcano of chard on the table. It was enormous. And I looked at that, and it's like, oh my gosh, we'll never get through that, you know. But we were chopping away, and at some point I looked up, and the pile was almost gone, and it's like, whoa. It was kind of like this recognition, oh, you know, that was impermanent. It doesn't sound like much. I mean, it sounds like nothing. But the mind kind of in that moment opened to the truth of impermanence. So we can begin to, through this practice of reflecting on, recognizing that things are impermanent, we can begin to open to this truth a little bit. When we suffer around change, this can be a really helpful reflection too, as I was pointing to earlier, that when we recognize the rub around impermanence, oh, something's gone and I really wanted that thing. That suffering is pointing us to the fact that we're not taking in the truth of impermanence. And so using that sense of rote burn as a guide around the that we're not really meeting the truth. This is a pointer to truth. Can we take it in? Then the second reflection, cultivating the perception of unreliability. So again, perception, cultivating a perception, you know, that means basically turning our minds to recognize a particular aspect of experience. We can, for instance, cultivate the perception of sound. You know, we can turn our attention towards sound. We can also cultivate perception in this other way of kind of attuning ourselves to recognizing change. We can attune ourselves to recognizing unreliability. So unreliability is kind of it's what we could call a corollary of the fact that things are impermanent. Because things are impermanent, because everything in our experience, all things everywhere are destined to fall apart in some form or other, at some time or other, and often we have no control over the timing of that falling apart. Because things are destined to fall apart, they are inherently unreliable as a place or as a source of happiness for us. So again, the truth of this is demonstrated to us really regularly. Things break, they get lost, our state of mind changes. We were happy for a little while and then we're lonely. We were feeling peaceful and then we got agitated. So things change, and if we are counting on things to be a certain way, we will suffer when they inevitably change. And so again, reflecting on how on that unreliability. That's again, it's bringing this consciously to mind. This is using our thoughts, actually. It's especially in daily life, consciously reflecting on, you know, where am I looking for happiness? And is that place where I'm looking for happiness a very reliable place for happiness? The Buddha encouraged us in this way to kind of look at things in stages. He said, look at where you find happiness. Take that in. Yes, there is a happiness of having things. That is a kind of happiness. We do experience gladness, delight when we get something that we like, when we succeed in doing something. There's a form of happiness there. And the Buddha said, well, acknowledge that, recognize that. But in the ways that you normally search for happiness, he said, look and see. How long does that happiness last? How satisfying is it really to have that piece of chocolate? Or how satisfying is it really to have that relationship? I mean, relationships can be very much a beautiful part of our lives. And yet we have in our minds the idea that they need to stay at some specific place as opposed to being a dynamic, fluid, changing thing. So finding, you know, the entryway into relationship that's willing to allow that fluidity of things sometimes being pleasant, happy, peaceful, easeful, glad, joyful, delightful, and other times being conflicted and confused and irritated and annoyed. We can't rely on any particular state of mind. We can't rely on any particular accumulation of things for happiness. And the Buddha suggests just see how long the happiness lasts in the ways that you usually look for happiness. And then begin recognizing the unreliability of the ways in which you usually look for happiness. In that recognition of unreliability, the Buddha doesn't just leave us there, actually. This is kind of a staged way that he encourages us to explore. He says, you'll notice that the kind of the happiness that comes from having or wanting, the happiness that comes from getting what we want, that's a pretty fleeting kind of happiness. There's a deeper kind of happiness that can come from cultivating a stable mind that is non-reactive to change. There's a deeper kind of happiness that comes from cultivating a mind that's balanced and quiet. And so he encourages us to cultivate those skills. Kind of as a way, essentially, it's like, well, there's this unreliability, right? There's this unreliability of the world. And he encourages us to find a well-being that is independent of the unreliability of the world. The well-being of a mind that is able to settle in concentration. The well-being of a mind that is not reactive to change. It's way more happiness producing. It's a deeper kind of happiness, that kind of well-being, than the happiness that comes from getting things that we think we want. So again, when we suffer around unreliability, it's a guide for us. We can look at that as being a teacher. It's pointing to truth. Then the third aspect, cultivating the perception of not self. So this one is a little more challenging, but I'll try to give a little bit of a description or a discussion around how you might explore this one. I hope the first two are clear enough. So this perception, cultivating the perception of not self, that the understanding of not self is kind of a corollary to impermanence as well. In a way, when we begin to recognize the truth of impermanence, we may still think there are things out there. You know, it's like, yeah, here's this glass, for instance. And we may know, okay, this glass is impermanent. It may break someday. But we still think of it as a thing. You know, it's something that's there, and then it's not there. But that's the way, one way we can relate to things being impermanent, that there are things out there, and they come and they go. The understanding around not self is a kind of a deeper understanding of impermanence, that essentially everything is in such constant flux that there aren't even any things out there. Now that sounds a little strange. But, actually, modern-day physics agrees with this. You know, that there are these, like, changing, rapidly fluctuating particles of things appearing into, or particles changing state constantly. There's not even necessarily a thing that's a particle, at least, you know, it's like the energy changes and it becomes something else. So there's just this flow of changing particles. And the way our perceptual apparatus is constructed, we don't see that level of change. And so our minds create this sense of things being around. The Buddha pointed to, he said, this is a truth that there's no like particular, there's no thing here that is me, no entity that is Andrea. There's just this continual change. And we can look at this like think about a tree. You know, what is a tree? It began its life as a seed or an acorn, perhaps, some kind of a, you know, so there is this acorn. And that acorn was created from another tree. It grew, it fell to the ground. And given conditions, that acorn, you know, got enough moisture and enough soil and enough sun, and it kind of sent out a taproot and it sent out a sprout and it went into the soil. So conditions are changing. And then it grows. It's got this process by which it grows. It's nature that it grows. There's no... Well, many of us would kind of understand that there's no tree being in there doing that growing. It's just nature. The nature of an acorn is to become an oak tree given certain conditions. And there are laws of nature that have it grow in a certain way. It creates its form and structure. It's just nature that it grows. There's no entity there doing that process. It is simply a process of nature. And at any two moments, one moment to the next, that process is producing something different. From one moment to the next, that tree is not the same. That may be a little harder to see, but I think you can kind of get that. I mean, you know, the leaves grow a little fuller and the bark grows a little bit more thick and the roots go a little deeper, or something, a bird, you know, pecks a hole in it, or, you know, there's all kinds of ways in which that tree is changing because of just conditions. Causes and conditions have the tree come into being. Causes and conditions create change in that tree. Our lives are much the same. We have these processes at work in our minds that have us believing that I am. But it's just a process. It's a process of nature that believes I am. So I'll leave that part as that. One of the ways the Buddha talked about exploring this truth of not self, he said, what do we think of when we think of self? You know, often we think of something that has some kind of control, of agency. You know, that we think, I'm going to stand up, and we stand up, you know. So there's some kind of control there. I'm going to do this or that today. You know, so there's that sense of control. And the Buddha asked us to reflect on control. Just how much control do you have over your mind? Just how much control do you have over your body? He pointed at this as a way to reflect on or point to this understanding of not self. And so this is something I think we can more relate to as a reflection. The Buddha's words are, the body is not self. If the body were self, it would be possible to say, may my body be thus. May my body not be thus. But it is not possible to say may my body be this. It is not possible to say that, he says, because body is not self. He goes through other things. May the mind, mind is not self. He said, if mind were self, consciousness were self, it would be possible to say, may consciousness be thus. May consciousness not be thus. But it is not possible because consciousness is not self. Again, this truth is actually staring us in the face, but we don't see it because our perceptual filters are oriented around I, me, mine, around the sense of me doing things, having things. So the Buddha suggests look at this notion of control. How much control do you have over your body? How much control do you have over your feelings? How much control do you have? Can you, when anger arises, say, may I not be angry? Often we can't. We can't do that. We can explore that anger. We can recognize anger is happening. And this is also a way to begin to recognize the not-self nature of these processes. So anger is arising. Emotion is arising. Some kind of thing is arising. We don't have control over it. Rather than feeling like we're failing, like, well, if I knew, if I was a good person, I would not have this anger. Or if I was a better person, I would be able to stop this anger. Rather than having that perspective of I should have control, the Buddha suggests a perspective of can you recognize, first, that there is no control, and second, this is a process that's happening. Anger is happening right now. Rather than taking ownership of that anger, identifying with that anger, recognizing it, oh, this is a process arising. It's much as that tree is growing. Here's the plant that's growing right now. The anger plant is growing. What is this about? Let's look at that. Can we meet that without feeling, without taking it personally? So a reflection on the perception, cultivating the perception of not-self is one of the ways to look at that is cultivating the perception of where is there not control and cultivating the recognition of cause and effect. That's another way to explore this this perception. That we see, that's like, I was just on a trip and there were some interactions with some people that, it's like, I see when that person does that, this reaction happens. Oh, wow, it's like they pushed a button. Okay, that's cause and effect. Okay, it's like, I couldn't say, may my mind not do that. May my mind not react that way. It's like, oh, okay, that's the cause and effect understanding, recognizing this is a follow-on, this is a consequence. So again, this is a pointer to truth, and if it feels like things are out of control, that's a pointer to truth. Rather than feeling like there's something wrong, recognizing it's like this. This is truth. Things are out of control. Now, it's not saying that, you just have to let things be out of control and just be, flailing wildly. We do what we can. And yet, taking ownership of the control, taking ownership of the process is where the suffering really grabs us because we don't have control over the whole process. And when we take ownership of that control, it's kind of like the rope burn again. It's like, I am this way. I am like this. And it's not okay for this to be happening. I was on retreat at one point and recognizing a sense of insecurity with my situation. And at some point, the mind just welled up and said, this is not acceptable. And I was like, well, wait a minute. You know, it is like this. This is the way it is. So if there's a rub, again, if there's a rub around things feeling out of control, using that as a guide, using that as a teacher. So there's a distinction between this kind of use of reflection to help us orient towards seeing through these familiar distortions, cultivating the perception of impermanence, of unreliability, of not self. Using thought, using our conscious minds helps us to kind of set the stage for seeing more deeply. But there is a distinction between that kind of reflective process. It's like the surface mind understanding the language, the surface mind orienting towards seeing that these things are happening. Kind of like that distinction I talked about, you know, with the vegetables, that I could see, yeah, things are changing here, but somehow it just wasn't, it's like, well, yeah, okay. You know, there wasn't like there was any surprise around that. It's like, well, yeah, I know that these things change. But then there was that one day when it's like, oh my God, that pile of chard, it's vanished. It is not there. And there was this, you know, just a little bit of an opening to a deeper truth around impermanence. So this deeper seeing around these truths often can happen, can be cultivated in our meditation. We can begin to see so clearly the changing nature of our experience. You know, if you sit down and meditate, you know, you sit down and look at your experience, you quickly see how quickly things are changing. You know, body sensation comes and goes. What we think of as this solid body is just kind of a massive vibration. That's the experience of it. It's nothing very solid. There's some solid places, like the sensation of the butt on the chair or something. You feel some solidity there. But if you explore even that, there's a sense of there being some changing experience. So in the exploration, the meditative exploration, we begin to see at a much deeper level just how quickly things are changing. We begin to see at a much deeper level just how unreliable things are because they're changing so quickly. And we begin to see really clearly just how out of control our minds are. I mean, the very first exercise we do in meditation often is sit down, try to pay attention to your breath. So, okay, we try to do that. And what happens? The mind wanders. Who did that? Did you do that? You were sitting down to try to pay attention to the breath. When we really begin to watch this, we see that there's just a set of processes at work. Sitting down, paying attention to the breath, there's a sound, the sound of a car. The mind recognizes that car and begins to think about cars and begins to think about where that car might be going and begins to go out in down Whipple Avenue and out to 101 and up to San Francisco, and then there we are in San Francisco. It's cause and effect. You didn't wander. The mind had a process by which it lost track of the present moment. So that very first practice of meditation begins to point out to us how our minds are out of control, that they are not self. These truths are staring us in the face, but it's very hard to take them in. So deeply seeing these truths, as the more that we really connect with these truths, the more that we really cultivate these perceptions of impermanence, unreliability, of not self, the mind naturally begins to understand this way my normal way of finding happiness, my normal way, by trying to hold on to things, trying to arrange the world to suit me, is destined to exhaustion. Maybe we can do it. You know, it's kind of like sandcastles, right? You know, you've got a sandcastle and the wave comes like, oh, got to build that part up, got to build that part up. And another wave comes, oh, got to build that part up. That's how we live our lives. It's exhausting trying to find happiness in something that's continually slipping away, continually changing. The more deeply we see these truths, the more deeply we really begin to connect with the truth of impermanence, the truth of unreliability, the truth of not self, the more the mind recognizes, you know, that way of finding happiness is not going to do it. It's not a satisfying way. And the mind begins to let go of trying to find happiness in that way. And paradoxically, in the very letting go, the mind finds happiness. In the letting go of trying to endlessly arrange, the mind finds peace. It's not where we would expect to find it. And so when the mind deeply understands things are impermanent, it realizes it's pointless to try to hold on. When it recognizes the understanding, really deeply understands that things are unreliable, it realizes the fruitlessness of holding on, of trying to arrange things in that way. And when it understands deeply that things are not self, it understands there's nothing to hold on to anyway. There isn't even anything to hold on to. And the mind begins to let go of orienting towards that way of finding happiness. So sometimes we have these moments, brief moments of seeing clearly, a moment of recognize. I've had these moments on retreat. It's like, wow, everything is just continually changing. And the mind has let go of picking things up. And it's such a relief. It's like, wow, this is so clear. How could I not see this? How could I not see that happiness cannot be found by holding on to things? How could I not see that? And yet, 2 minutes later, the mind is back trying to hold on to something, back trying to grab hold, control. Insights are also impermanent. And yet, there's a way when we've had that kind of an insight. It's true that we don't live often when we have that kind of an insight. It comes and goes. The conditions for being able to see that clearly, for that kind of clear seeing, come and go. But having seen that clearly, there is a way that we see when the distortions come back. We see, oh, those are distortions operating. We begin to understand, oh, that the mind is doing things in a way that's not so helpful. And so there's a way that those insights are part of us, because it's like we've changed somehow. Our understanding is different now. Even if we're not living from that place of knowing it in that moment, there's a way in which we've understood something that we didn't understand before. And it gives us the faith, the confidence to keep going, to keep making this exploration. And we also see in that place just how much freedom there is in letting go. So, well, I've talked the whole time, so no time for questions. I'm sorry about that. Thank you for your attention.